whenever the president finds that the entry of any aliens or any class of aliens would be detrimental to the interests of the United States, he may, by proclamation, and for such period as he, see, it wasn't politically correct, because they should have said he or she. You know, today they'd say that. That's all. Actually, that's the only mistake they made. As he shall deem necessary, suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens as immigrants or non-immigrants, or impose on the entry of aliens any restrictions he may deem to be appropriate.
President Donald Trump reading from a congressional statute about the president's power to restrict travel into the United States. That was back in March after a federal court put a stay on his revised travel ban. Well, this morning, the Supreme Court partially lifted that stay and agreed to consider the case when it starts its new term in the fall. Trump's ban limits travel from six Muslim-majority countries for 90 days and suspends the U.S. refugee program for 120 days. In other Supreme Court news, the justices also agreed to hear a case involving a Colorado baker who refused to bake a wedding cake for a same-sex couple, and it sided with the Missouri Lutheran Church in a big church versus state decision. There is a lot to talk about, and here to explain it all is Loyola Law School professor and Press Play regular Jessica Levinson. Good to talk with you, Jessica.
Thank you for having me.
So what did the justices say in this travel ban decision? Why did they reverse the lower courts?
Well, it's kind of a partial reverse. So this decision, I think, really speaks to the divide of the court, the ideological divide. So this was a 6-3 decision. The court is going to take the case, hear the issue of the constitutionality or legality of the travel ban, and it said we're lifting the stay, and the stay, again, pressed pause on the implementation of the travel ban. So by lifting the stay, it means the travel ban is implemented, but only with respect to some people. So let's say that again. The travel ban will be in effect if you do not have a bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the United States.
And that's right, a person or a family, have family in the U.S.
Right. And that's what a lot of the discussion will be about until the court hears the case in October.
Well, exactly, because three of the conservative justices, they dissented from what they called this compromise decision. And they said that this policy is going to be hard for border control to administer. You know, who has a bona fide connection? What does that mean? Is that a valid criticism?
Well, the conservatives said it's unworkable. I mean, it's not ideal, but the court did lay out some things that we look at. So, for instance, do you have enough of a connection with a person or family member? Do you have a close relationship with that person? These are fact-based inquiries. That means that it can get messy. Do you have enough of a relationship with an entity? The court said, for instance, have you been accepted to a university? Have you been offered a place of employment with an organization? So there's going to be a lot of filings between now and October. There'll be a lot of emergency motions to say this person should get a visa, this person should not get a visa. And a lot of it's going to be based on this. Is there enough of a relationship? So it's messy, but messy doesn't mean unworkable. Messy means six justices were able to cobble together a majority. And that's, I think, what happened here.
Well, the court, of course, also said they'll hear the case in the fall, but they acknowledge that it probably or could be moot at this point, and that's because the administration will have had time to review vetting procedures.
I think this is maybe the biggest story coming out of the decision to hear the travel ban, which is the court explicitly said, we're going to decide whether or not the travel ban is moot by the time we hear it in October. So as you said, the travel ban itself has limits of 90 days and 120 days. Now, October is more than 120 days away from whenever the travel ban will go into effect. And President Trump has said it will be in 72 hours. So I think that there is at least a decent chance that the court in October will say, you know what? 90 days has passed. 120 days has passed. This right. case is moot. Thank you so much. And I do think there are some justices who would like to avoid the issue of the merits, particularly, I think, Chief Justice John Roberts, who doesn't want to preside over more political and ideologically divided decisions, particularly on such a hot button issue like this.
Well, we've got to move on. There's so much to talk about. And the other case the court agreed to take up is this case involving the Colorado baker who refused to bake a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. My question is, what could this mean for states like California that already prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation?
Well, depending on what the court says, this could have an effect for a number of different states. And this, of course, what we have is a state that said you're not allowed to discriminate on the basis of not just race, but also sexual orientation. So you have to, Colorado baker, you have to bake this cake for a same-sex couple. Now, he says that infringes on my First Amendment rights. And this is a clash that I think a lot of people saw coming the last few years. It's going to be between non-discrimination against LGBTQ communities and against allegations that that infringes on the free exercise of religion. So what the court says and the contours of the court's decision in this case could absolutely have an effect in many states that have these non-discrimination laws. And again, we're in this place because there's no federal law for non-discrimination.
Right. And the states have been left to deal with it. And separately, but hinging on this, the court also ruled 6-3 to strike down an Arkansas law that barred same-sex couples from having both their names added to their child's birth certificate. So where do you see this headed? Does this give any indication how the court might rule in the Colorado case?
Well, I think what was interesting in the Arkansas case is that the new justice, Neil Gorsuch, actually dissented from that decision. And he tried to basically narrow the scope of the Obergefell decision, the same-sex marriage decision from a few years ago. And a lot of people who were hoping that maybe Justice Gorsuch wouldn't be all that conservative now understand that, oh, no, he absolutely is as conservative as he was promised to many people, and potentially to the right of Justice Alito, and maybe even to the right of Justice Thomas, which is hard to do in the grand scheme of things.
So this was a big red light for those less conservative court watchers.
I think this was a great indication to a lot of people. If you're a conservative, this was welcome news. If you're a liberal, this was terrifying news.
Finally, the court also sided with a Missouri Lutheran church in a decision that could have some big implications for the church. And I'd like you to catch us up to speed on this case because I think this was kind of under the radar. It involved public funding for a playground, protective surface for a playground, right? What was at issue?
Right. So basically, the church wanted to rubberize their playground because it was going to be safer for the kids if they could use, I think it was recycled tires for the playground. And they wanted to apply to be part of a public program where they could get reimbursement, public funds back for doing that.
So taxpayer dollars went
coming
towards
to the church.
Yeah, coming to the church.
And they were denied that ability. And what the Supreme Court said today is, no, that violates the First Amendment. So just because you're a church doesn't mean that you shouldn't be able to avail yourself of a secular program. And that's what this is. The idea is anybody should apply for reimbursement for rubberizing your playground. Are you a church? Are you a public school? Are you some sort of other non-religious entity? And so what the court said today is really, the only reason you were denied this money is because you were a religious affiliation. And the First Amendment doesn't allow us to discriminate either against people who are not religious or against people, in this case, who are religious.
Well, parse this for us, because in her dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote that the ruling leads us to a place where separation of church and state is a constitutional slogan, not a constitutional commitment.
Well, and that's exactly why Missouri and other states had in their constitution these limitations saying no government money, no public funds for churches, because they wanted to draw a bright line between church and state. I think everybody who's been following the court knows that that line isn't all that bright. And I think what Justice Sotomayor is concerned about, and a lot of people in favor of the separation of church and state are concerned about, is this kind of death by a thousand paper cuts approach to the distinction between church and state, and the idea that we just keep blurring the line to the extent that it's just a line drawn in the sand on a windy day at a certain point.
Hmm. And finally, what do you make of the rumors of Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement, since we only have a few more moments? You know, Kennedy is usually the swing vote on big cases. He's 80 years old. There was a lot of the rumor mill was very busy going into the end of this term.
Justice Kennedy is the most powerful jurist in the world. He was in the majority, I think, more than 95% of the time this term in closely divided cases. I think that he'll be loath to give that position up, but this is a favorite kind of parlor game or discussion in, you know, cocktail parties among many court watchers. Some people have said, let's look at the tea leaves, the fact that the court has decided to take this Colorado case involving the man who didn't want to bake the cake for the same-sex couple. That indicates that Justice Kennedy wants to stay on and he wants to solidify the legacy of the same-sex marriage decision. That may be true. I think if Justice Kennedy wanted to retire, that probably wouldn't stand in his way. But, you know, there's so much gossip about whether Justice Kennedy will retire because it's so incredibly important. But nobody knows.
Sure. I just consider it a victory. We got you to consider tea leaves. Jessica Levinson is a law professor at Loyola Law School. And you join us every Monday here on Press Play. And it's so nice for me to get to talk to you. Thank you.
A pleasure for me. Thank you.
Well, it's been 5 months now since President Trump introduced his 3-month travel ban, and the temporary suspension of travel was designed to give the government time to review and tighten the vetting process for foreigners coming here from 6 predominantly Muslim countries. So since the government has had 5 months to review its vetting and security processes, is the ban even needed anymore? Joining us now is Ron Nixon, Homeland Security correspondent for The New York Times. Hi, Ron.
Thanks for having me.
As I said, Homeland Security has had these 5 months to vet the vetting. What's it done in that time?
They say that they are looking at certain aspects and trying to create a uniform vetting process, because the injunctions that were done by the courts don't block that. However, Section 2, which directs them to review and identify what information they need from various countries, was enjoined. So because of that, their argument is that, well, we can't go and ask these countries what they do to make sure documents aren't fraudulently created or what checks they have on people. They're saying they can't do that. So,
and that's because of this ruling by the federal judge in Hawaii that blocked the revised ban,
right.
And he also blocked the government's review of vetting.
That's correct.
Okay, so there's truth to that. The vetting couldn't continue despite the block.
But the vetting process can continue. It's the asking. So Section 2 of the executive order directs the Department of Homeland Security and the Director of National Intelligence to look at these countries and their vetting processes of people. But the injunction blocked that. What the injunction did not block, again, was Section 5 of the executive order, which implemented a uniform screening and vetting standards for all immigration programs. So they can do that, and they say that they are doing that.
Well, here's the question, and it was the big one. Why did the government ever need to stop travel temporarily in the first place, since the U.S. already has these strict programs to keep criminals and security threats out of the country? They've been in place since 9/11. It can take years for people to get their visas approved. What programs are already in place, and how effective are they?
They have ICE agents who are deployed abroad at the embassies, at the consulates, that run background checks on people who are applying for visas. The embassy, State Department itself, has these diplomatic security personnel who do these background checks, and they have access to all the information that the intelligence folks have on people. There's the Immigration Advisory Program run by Customs and Border Protection, which allows them to advise airports on who to let on a plane and who to not let on a plane. And then there's pre-clearance that's at 15 airports around the country, where instead of going through customs once you get to the U.S., you actually go through customs through the pre-clearance programs in those countries. And they've stopped, the number is over 10,000 people were stopped from coming to the U.S. based on that.
Well, even though this travel ban has been put on hold, there have been disruptions on the ground for people trying to travel or to seek asylum from these 6 countries, right?
Yes. If you look at the data from the State Department, there has been a reduction in the number of people seeking to travel here. And part of that, I suspect, is that people didn't fear what happened when the original ban was put into place. You're on a plane, you're on your way here, and you land, and all of a sudden you're being told that, no, you can't come into the country, and you have to turn around and go back. So I think that that has put a damper on people trying to come to the country from those particular nations.
What happens now? Does the clock start ticking and all of the time that the administration has had to vet these programs, that's just null? We're going to start from zero?
Right. Basically, 72 hours from today, this would go into effect. Based on the memo that the president issued amending the stopwatch, so to speak, for this to start.
And so from your point of view, because you're so deep in the inside of this story, what do you think the administration is going to look at to tighten these restrictions?
You look at, are the documents that people submitting, are they fraudulent? You look at things like, what is the likelihood of someone who is coming here of overstaying their visa, because a large part of that undocumented community that has gotten so much attention, particularly under this administration, is people who simply overstayed their visa, not people who came across the border. And you know, most national security or homeland security experts you talk to say there's nothing wrong with that, but that we have all of these systems in place now that allows us to do this. And it's particularly in more recent years, there's just more information. The intelligence services have more access to the information that each one of the agencies has. So a lot of that is already in place.
Ron Nixon, he's Homeland Security correspondent for The New York Times. And thanks so much for taking the time today with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, would you or your family be affected by the partially reinstated travel ban? And what are your concerns? Weigh in on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Trump's border wall talk has heated up the arms race between drug cartels and border patrols. And you see it best underground. Smuggling tunnels are getting very high tech. We tour one with a San Diego reporter. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Madeline Brand. Despite campaign promises and rally chants, the Trump administration has failed to secure funding to build the wall along the Mexican border. No money will be spent on the wall this year, but Trump administration officials have reportedly asked for $1.5 billion to build more than 70 miles of wall next year. But with that price tag and no funding so far, President Trump is getting creative. Last week at a rally in Iowa, Trump floated the idea of covering the border wall in solar panels to recoup construction costs. As Trump pulls out all the stops to raise money for the wall, drug cartels are getting ever more creative with their tunnels to get under the wall, and they've built hundreds of them. Jean Guerrero reports on the U.S.-Mexico border at KPBS in San Diego. She's been covering developments in drug tunnels along the border. She joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, Barbara.
So first, Jean, tell us about the existing tunnels that date back to the 1990s when border fences first became a thing. Where are they and what are they like?
Right. So like you said, the first one was found in 1990, right around when the U.S. started building the border fence. And they run basically under the areas where we've built border fence, obviously, to get underneath it. So far, the U.S. has found almost 200 of these tunnels. And those are the ones that actually cross the border. The Mexican authorities have found close to 100 other openings before they were actually finished. So those didn't actually cross all the way. But yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of tunnels. There's sophisticated tunnels, rudimentary tunnels.
Right, there's this whole network, as you write. And now the drug cartels, you say, are upping their game in response to this crackdown on border security. And you got to tour one of these high-tech new tunnels that Border Patrol keeps open for training purposes since they found it. What's it like?
Yeah. So that one's called the Galvez Tunnel. It's one of the sophisticated tunnels. When I say sophisticated, it basically means they've got electricity, so lighting, they've got ventilation, they have railway systems to transport drugs. So this tunnel in particular, called the Galvez Tunnel, that was found in 2009, was left open. Normally, the U.S. plugs these tunnels up with cement when they're found, but this one was so stable and so perfect for training purposes that they decided to leave it open, and they train a team of people that they call the Tunnel Rats, the Border Patrol's tunnel entry team, and they're the ones who deal with the tunnels when they're found on the U.S. side.
So this this one has lights, right? And some of them had elevators.
Yeah, so I went in there. It's like 90 feet underground. And you can walk around, you can like spread your arms wide open. It's a huge tunnel. They call it the Cadillac of tunnels. And yeah, it's got lights all along the walls. A lot of these tunnels are what they call shored with cement, but this one has the natural sandstone walls because the geology is already so stable. And yeah, at the very, you can walk through it, like from one side to the other in like 20 seconds because most of it was plugged up. They've got this big stack of sandbags where they blocked it off so that you can't come in from the Mexican side anymore.
Well, it's serious business. I mean, you also write that cartels are going as far as consulting with top engineers in Europe to perfect the architecture. This is boutique tunneling.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's so lucrative for them because, I mean, authorities estimate that it costs about $1 million to make one of these sophisticated tunnels. And single drug seizures inside of these tunnels are typically in the multi-million dollar range. I mean, sometimes $20 million. So that tells you that the cartels are making millions and millions of dollars a day through these tunnels. So it's profitable.
Well, you describe this as a kind of arms race between Border Patrol and the drug cartels. So what problems is this ramp up of sophistication causing border enforcement? Are they harder to detect these tunnels?
Yeah, the technology that they have right now is very limited. The tunnel rats themselves, the people who deal with the tunnels, they were telling me that the technology is very much lacking. They have to rely on just like good old fashioned police work is what they call it. Just relying on tips from people who perhaps hear like the suspicious jackhammer drill sounds or see large piles of dirt. But the technology, I mean, there's like ground penetrating radar. There's stuff that detects infrared and shifts in gravitational fields. But a lot of this gets thrown off by the subtlest interference from radio waves, surface noise, like a lot of the cross-border traffic running through these areas, and just like the mixed geology, porous, rocky. It's really hard to detect these tunnels at the depth at which they are now being built. I mean, they're being built deeper underground. They are increasingly sophisticated. And increasingly, they're smaller and smaller. So even though they're getting smaller, they're still very sophisticated with the railway systems that make it possible to move huge amounts of drugs.
And getting back to the administration's plans, we know about the wall, but what do we know about what Trump wants to do to stop tunneling?
So in the request for proposals that the Department of Homeland Security put out for the wall, they say that they want a wall that is going to be able to prevent tunneling for at least 6 feet under the ground.
You said this was 90 feet under the ground, the one you wanted to. Yeah.
Yeah. So the only tunnels that you'll actually find 6 feet under are the most rudimentary tunnels, the ones that that Border Patrol calls gopher holes. And those are not, you know, the ones that are being used to move incredible amounts of drugs. So, yeah, I mean, currently the wall doesn't exactly address the tunneling problem. Some of the companies that put in requests for proposals say they want to mix up the actual barrier with tunnel detection technology. But like I said, that's very much it still has a long way to go.
What about good old following the money?
Right. So one of the investigators that I spoke to said that that the banks are what he calls the major tunnel in the drug market. He considers it, several researchers consider it a major blind spot in our fight against drug trafficking. The cartels are earning billions of dollars, and this money is moving through the banks. And he says that that's where the fight needs to be focused, and it's currently not focused there on trying to track this money and go straight to the people who are profiting.
Jean Guerrero, she's Fronteras reporter at KPBS in San Diego. And you can find a link to her story on our website, kcrw.com/pressplay. Thank you so much for talking with me today, Jean.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Coming up, writer Roxane Gay on how the trauma of being raped by a group of boys at age 12 led her to eat and eat and eat.
I was swallowing my secrets and making my body expand and explode. I found ways to hide in plain sight, to keep feeding a hunger that could never be satisfied.
Roxane Gay on her new memoir, Hunger. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. Writer Roxane Gay was brutally gang raped by a group of boys when she was just 12 years old. She didn't tell anyone because she was filled with shame. And so to cope, she said she began to fill herself up with food.
I was swallowing my secrets and making my body expand and explode. I found ways to hide in plain sight, to keep feeding a hunger that could never be satisfied, the hunger to stop hurting. I made myself bigger. I made myself safer. I created a distinct boundary between myself and anyone who dared to approach me.
Roxane gained more and more weight, and not just 40 pounds, hundreds of pounds. Roxane Gay's new memoir about this is called Hunger. She calls it a memoir of her body. And she spoke with Madeline last week.
You write that this is not a book about living in the world where you are obese or morbidly obese. You write that you're heavier than that, super morbidly obese, as it's called, but you don't like those terms at all. Why do you not like those terms? How do they make you feel? And what would you prefer to be called?
I think those terms are terms that attempt to pathologize the human body. And I understand why the medical establishment needs a taxonomy of bodies, but when people use those terms to refer to people just living their lives, it can be really frustrating. And in many ways, as I write in the book, it terms the body as, that you're the walking dead, when such is not the case. And so it's just frustrating. Mm-hmm. And honestly, as a culture, we just don't have people are uncomfortable talking about bodies, and they're especially uncomfortable talking about fat bodies. And so, it's just, I think there are better words than obese or morbidly obese.
Such as what?
Fat, I think, works. Person of size works.
Yeah. So something that's just more direct and not so medicalized.
I think something that's not so medicalized.
You write in the book that there is a whole medicalization of fat people that has seeped into the popular culture on shows like the shows that are about transforming people, Biggest Loser, for example, and the doctors, or even Oprah Winfrey in a certain way did that on her show. Can you talk about that and how, why it is that we have this fascination and yet repulsion with fat people?
Yeah, I don't know where it comes from. I think a lot of it is fat phobia because people know how they treat fat people and don't want to be treated that way themselves. But we have a cultural fascination with the fat body and watching the process of the fat body coming under discipline. Whether it's a show like The Biggest Loser or My 600-Pound Life or Extreme Makeover Body Edition. And, you know, all of these shows, what they do is offer a narrative where you see the fat person and they are diagnosed as fat. And then there is a recitation of all the ways in which their body is failing. And then they try to redeem themselves through diet and exercise in these really artificial circumstances provided by these various shows. And, you know, people have a lot of opinions about fat bodies, and pretty much anyone who has an opinion about a fat body thinks that they're a medical doctor, which is fascinating because I thought medical school took 8 years. But, yeah, it's just frustrating to watch. And, I think that people are always fascinated by unruly bodies and by bodies that don't conform.
Yeah, and then a lot of people say, well, there is a medical solution to someone who is fat, really fat, like you, and that is gastric bypass surgery. But you reject that, and you write about it in your book as something that is not for you because it is dangerous, and I'm ultimately, I guess, unproven in terms of its long-term effects. And so, you know, this idea that there is a medical solution to something that is more, much more complicated seems to me very American.
It is a very American thing, but because I think that American food culture is unique, and the size of American bodies is fairly unique, though increasingly we're seeing other countries who are dealing with what the media loves to call the obesity epidemic.
Mm-hmm. An epidemic. It's a disease.
Yes.
You don't see it that way.
No, I do not.
Did it take you a long time to come to that?
No, it didn't. I'm not under any sort of illusions about what it's like to be overweight, but I don't think it has to be pathologized. Uh-huh. I don't think that people need to be diminished or denigrated because of it. I think that it's very difficult to lose weight, and I think that a lot of the options that are available are really challenging. You know, a lot of people are increasingly opting for weight loss surgery, and I support that. I think everyone should do what's right for them. And I've considered it before, and I know I will consider it again. But it's just challenging. There's no magic bullet. Oftentimes, you have to change your inner state before you can change your outer state. And I also think that it's important to recognize that there are some people who don't see fat as a problem, and actually don't see fat as a problem. It's not an internal problem, it's an external problem. The world is inhospitable to fat people. But I don't think we should be punished for our bodies.
You write, though, that you're conflicted about that yourself. In one chapter, you start the chapter off by saying, I hate myself, or society tells me I'm supposed to hate myself. So I guess this, at least, is something I'm doing right. And then a couple of paragraphs down, you say, but I also like myself. And then you say, for so long, I gave in to my self-loathing and I refused to allow myself the simple pleasure of accepting who I am and how I live. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you still struggle with that, or have you come to a place of acceptance?
No, I still struggle. I do, because I definitely want to be smaller, and I'm working on it, and I'm not apologetic about that. But I don't feel like I should be. People want me to, like, sort of perform shame about being fat and self-flagellate for that. And I've done that for many, many years. And for what? It doesn't solve anything. It doesn't change anything. And I don't think I should have to punish myself for my body. So I'm conflicted about it. But I try not to punish myself. And I try to not demean myself simply because of the nature of my body.
So your life has a clear before and after. Before you were raped at the age of 12, and you were normal sized at the time. And then after, you were gang raped by a boy that you
thought you loved, that you had a crush on, and his friends, and they lured you to a cabin in the woods. So they had planned it out. And then they took turns raping you. And after you pulled yourself together and went home, you didn't tell anyone. And I was just wondering, what were you thinking at the time? I don't know if you can go back to that afternoon, but what were you thinking as you were going home and later that evening?
I was just thinking, I can't let Mom and Dad know. I was actually in sort of panic mode of how do I hide this? How do I clean myself up without anyone finding out? And that was like those were, from 30 years ago, but those were my immediate thoughts. Just how do I hide this? Because no one can know.
And you were able to do that for a long time with them.
Yes, I was. I still don't know how, but, you know, I think when you're a good kid and you always do what you're told, you know how to get away with things. And so I just I kept it secret for a very long time.
And was that because you thought that they would think it was your fault in some way, that you had initiated that in some way? Why did you not want to tell them?
I think I blamed myself for letting it happen and for being so gullible. And we are Catholic, and so I was worried that I was going to go to hell because I had premarital sex.
And just so the listeners know, you portray a pair of very loving parents. These are not
parents
who would have shamed you necessarily.
No, not at all. I mean, it wasn't rational. I was 12, and it was a different time. You know, we didn't talk about sexual violence the way we do today, and Lord knows we still have work to do, but 30 years ago, it was completely different. And so I didn't have a vocabulary. I didn't even know what rape was or that it was a possibility. And so everything in my world was changed. And my parents were very religious, but they did raise us to believe God is a God of love. And so all my fears were just the fears of a child who just didn't have the maturity to know that you can trust your parents. My parents were and are incredible.
So you started eating
yes.
and eating and eating and eating as a way of coping and as a way of preventing other boys from doing the same thing to you. Was that a conscious thought or was it just were you just seeking solace in food?
It was fairly conscious. I mean, food was comforting, absolutely. But it was also the one thing that was like readily available. And I had been overpowered. And so I just thought, I want to make myself bigger. I want to make myself stronger. And I also thought, boys don't like fat girls, because I lived in the world, of course, and I saw how they treated fat kids. And so I thought maybe I could do that to protect myself. But absolutely, comfort was also part of it.
And there's another contradiction there, that you say that you wanted to disappear in a way so that no boys would notice you.
Mm-hmm.
But there you are, making yourself more obvious, bigger. More present.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fat body oftentimes offers that contradiction where you are highly visible because of your size, but you also become invisible. People look right through you. Huh. So, yeah, it's both. It's a contradiction.
When did your parents finally find out what happened to you?
In 2014.
So just 3 years ago.
Yes.
And they found out because you had written about it in Bad Feminist? Your previous book?
Yes. They found out from a Time magazine article.
So what was their reaction?
They were, you know, surprised. Not surprised, but I was really passive about it. I knew they were going to figure it out or find out eventually because of the book, but I was really passive in terms of how they found out because I didn't know how to have the conversation. And so, you know, I think my dad was hurt. Because he really wanted me to have told him when I was 12. And other than that, they were incredibly supportive. And I think that a lot of unanswered questions were suddenly answered about the change that overcame their daughter.
Do you think that they could have done anything, though? I mean, do you think they could have done anything to alleviate your hurt, your shame, your trauma?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that they would have gotten me the help I needed. And that would have alleviated a lot of the hurt and shame. I think it would have taken a lot of time, absolutely, because I was really traumatized. But I know that I would have had help. A 12-year-old, especially the 12-year-old that I was 30 years ago, who was so sheltered, doesn't have the coping skills at all.
Right. When did you fully realize what had happened to you?
Oh, I fully knew. I mean, I didn't have a vocabulary for it, but I knew something terrible had happened. And then there was the aftermath. And then in high school, I would write stories about young girls being violated in terrible ways. And my sophomore English teacher, Mr. McGuinn, saw these stories and could tell something was really wrong. And so he took me to, I went to boarding school. And so he took me to the counseling center on campus. And I started going to therapy. And one of my therapists gave me a copy of a book called The Courage to Heal, which has actually been discredited. But at the time, it gave me a vocabulary for sexual assault and rape. And I didn't have language at 12, but at 15 and 16 and 17, I did finally start to have language and recognize that I was not alone. I was not the only person this had happened to.
And then when you're a lot older, you actually find the boy who's now a man. Mm-hmm. You find where he is. You find out where he works. And you call him up and get him on the phone. And he says, hello, 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 and you don't say anything. And then it's an amazing moment. You both stay on the line for a while, just silent. Do you think that he knew it was you on the other end of the line?
I don't know. I still don't know. I don't know. Part of me would like to think that the reason we both stayed on the line so long is that he knew and I was waiting for him to sort of acknowledge that it was me. But I really don't know.
Did you want to say something or did you?
I didn't. I didn't want to, like, I wanted to be able to say something perfect. Like, I wanted to have a script and I didn't. I called him impulsively at his employer. I don't know his personal phone number. I called him at his place of work. And I just wanted to be able to say, like, the perfect, most incisive thing. And I didn't have the words, and I was just too shy and too scared. But I'm sure there would have been some profanity.
Is there any part of you that wants him to know exactly what he did to you? I mean, to say, look, here I am. This is what your actions have caused. You have caused someone immeasurable amounts of pain. You need to face that, and here I am in your face. Do you ever want to do that?
Part of me wants that, but part of me thinks that the kind of person he is wouldn't care.
Yeah. And that would be more hurtful.
Correct. So, I mean, I would want that if he was the kind of person who would be receptive and who would even understand what he did. But I don't know that the kind of person who can commit this kind of crime is capable of empathy.
So you have spent, you're very visible now. You're famous. You're very visible online. You're a writer, best-selling author. You're doing a lot of interviews. First of all, I just wanted to know, how is it talking about this all the time now? I mean, for years you avoided writing about it even. And now that this book is out, you're doing lots of interviews. And I'm just wondering how it is to talk about what happened to you, the most personal thing imaginable. And I'll, you know, this is a very personal story. How is it for you?
Pretty horrible.
Really?
Yeah. It's just unpleasant. I mean, people are just, it's just not great. But, you know, book promotion.
Right. So you don't like this conversation right now?
It's okay. It's just, you know, I think that people don't quite know how to talk about the book, and the kinds of things that people focus on are challenging. It's not like, you know, it's not painful to talk about the rape. I mean, it was horrible, but it was 30 years ago, and I have been in therapy for most of those 30 years, off and on, mm-hmm. as needed. So I have dealt, I'm as fixed as I'm going to be in that regard. But it's, you know, it's still challenging to talk about.
What would you prefer to talk about?
Anything else? I would prefer to talk about fat activism, the challenges of being a writer in a world where writing isn't necessarily respected. Channing Tatum.
Okay. What about Channing Tatum?
I mean, he's just flawless. What's not to love? Just very handsome and very charming. I like the idea of Channing.
So writing this book, you want to talk about writing. Was it difficult to write in terms of thinking of packaging it as a book that could be sold?
That wasn't the hard part. Because when I write, I don't think about like the marketing or the reader. I generally write telling myself no one's going to read it because that's the only way I'll be able to put the kinds of things I put on the page on the page. So for me, the challenge of writing this book was really just confronting myself and really looking at the history of my body, which is what this book tracks. And, you know, it was just challenging. It was challenging and uncomfortable, and that's how I knew it was the right book to write.
Mm-hmm. It does seem to be such a woman's problem, such a woman's issue, and I know a lot has been written about it and spoken about how, you know, fat is a feminist issue and all that. But as you are a feminist, and your previous book was called Bad Feminist, what are your thoughts on that and the fact that there are few men who write about weight and their bodies the way that women mm-hmm. do?
Well, I think in general, fat men, they are under less scrutiny. And that is not to say that fat men like have it easy, but it's different. And so we don't see a lot of that. And also, I think that in general, men are less inclined to write about their bodies. I actually would love to read something from a fat man about what it's like. But this in general it's not only a woman's problem, but women face bodily scrutiny in ways that men will never face or never know. And it's because women are expected to be sexual objects and to sort of cater to the male gaze at all times. And when we don't do that, there are problems and we have to discipline ourselves back toward that.
So in that sense, the idea of sexual violence and body image and fat are intertwined throughout the culture?
It depends. It really depends. I think it's really important to make clear that some people gain weight in response to sexual violence, but fatness is its own thing. There are many different reasons why people are fat. And it's important to just acknowledge that. It's just important to acknowledge that there are a range of ways in which bodies are. But there can be a connection there. And for me, that connection was there. I just always want to make clear that this is my story and it's not meant to serve as a justification. It's an explanation. It's a history of my body. But there are other bodies with other stories. And we have to acknowledge that as well.
Well, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you again. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Madeline.
That's Roxane Gay. Her new memoir is called Hunger, and she's going to be at the Aratani Theater in Little Tokyo tonight in conversation with journalist Anne Friedman. It's part of the Library Foundation's Aloud series.
And we're back with Christian Bardal, Monsieur Le Feedback.
Yes. Hi there, Barbara Bouquet. So nice to have you back here.
Oh, it's such a pleasure.
Press Play Studio.
So, what is on people's minds?
Well, a number of our listeners have reacted to Madeline's interview with Roxane Gay.
That was quick.
Yes. Mm. Sean Panzer says it's not just fat people who get body shamed. Sean writes it goes both ways. A friend of mine who's quite thin gets many, many comments implying that she has anorexia, when in reality, she's one of the healthiest people I know. She just has a slim build. It's unfortunate that this conversation always seems to turn into an us versus them situation.
That's true. It's kind of an interesting boundary conundrum.
And Shana says, I cannot thank Roxane Gay enough for sharing her life story. I coped the same way. And Tissue Paper says, I'm so here for Roxane Gay's interview. Honest and real. I shouldn't have to punish myself for my body.
Well, it really struck a chord. I'm so glad she was on the program. I really enjoyed the conversation. And that's it for us for today here on Press Play. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Christian Bordal, for being here. I'll see you tomorrow.